You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Rowan. Efai Akine coming up on the show. This week on The Wire, we are continuing with our election coverage, where we speak to politicians, academics, activists, experts, and more about different policy areas leading up to the election. This week, we are focusing on housing. Rowan, what have you got for us today?
I spoke with ACT MP Simon Court about some of the party's housing policies, including their council housing incentives, their Building Act reforms, and their plan to scrap the Resource Management Act. I also spoke with University of Auckland Professor of Economics Susan St. John about her recent article looking into what this election could mean for low-income households. I then spoke with Associate Professor of Criminology Alice Mills on her research looking at housing support for ex-prisoners.
And on the environment, which we covered last week, I spoke to Stop the Space Waste organiser Sam Murphy and Aerospace New Zealand president Mark Rocket about the aerospace industry in Aotearoa. Hei aha uwhakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō hi pakihiri rokiroki maurunga i te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about some of the ACT's policies to battle the housing crisis. We started off by discussing their incentive for councils to increase the building of residential housing, looking at why it's important and how it will work. This incentive aims to take a 50% GST from the revenue of new residential buildings and give it back to councils. We then discussed ACT's plans to scrap the Resource Management Act, talking about what they believe to be an excess of consents and regulations and focus more on development. I also asked about the reforms they plan to make to the Business Act and how this will link into the housing crisis. First up is your policy to incentivize housing by sharing 50% of GST from new residential buildings with councils. Walk us through how this policy will work.
Well, currently, councils face most of the cost for delivering the infrastructure, the pipes, the underground networks, and the roads that service new development. While developers pay for the roads and the pipes inside the development, council has to expand networks, upgrade wastewater treatment plants. And for every 5 or 10, 20,000 people that arrive in Auckland, this places a huge burden on what's called bulk infrastructure. ACT's proposal is for councils that sign off a building consent, and say around New Zealand, that would amount to around $2.5 billion worth of construction every year for residential alone, which is what the government collects in GST. What ACT would do is have half of that GST returned to the councils that sign off the consent, because it's those councils that face the most pressure for infrastructure upgrades. And actually, that's one of the reasons why very often they're reluctant to say yes to new subdivisions, because they know all of the costs are going to fall back on them. But apart from rates over a very long period of time, they don't have any revenue up front to fund the bulk infrastructure. So ACT thinks that would be a great way to incentivise councils to say yes to consents quickly, but also give them access to a revenue stream of $1.2 billion a year, which for Auckland would amount to around $400 million of extra revenue, which they could then use to leverage against borrowing to build bulk infrastructure, to upgrade our networks so that our city can grow up as well as out.
And will there be regulations in the specific areas councils can invest the GST collected and how they do so?
What ACT is also asking for is councils to propose their infrastructure plan, which would support 30 years of growth. Currently, councils have a district plan or a regional plan, in Auckland's case, a unitary plan, which was signed off in 2015, that shows where the next half to 1 million people are coming to live. For example, 250,000 people are coming to live between Kumeu and Silverdale in the north of Auckland, hundreds of thousands more in the south and east. The problem is there's no infrastructure plan that sits underneath the spatial plan or the growth plan. And what ACT would do is have those councils prepare a 30-year infrastructure plan, and then central government's role would be to sign off on that. Now, in order to continue receiving funds, to be eligible for funds from land transport grants and so on, ACT would want to see a government auditing councils to make sure they're actually meeting their infrastructure delivery targets that enables land for housing to be brought to market. Because it's bringing more land to the market that actually creates a downward pressure on price. That's what infrastructure for servicing land is intended to do. Now, I'm an engineer. I love building things, but actually the purpose of all of this infrastructure is so that more land can be brought to market at an affordable price. Instead of, say, Auckland is paying $600,000 for a section in a greenfield site now, there should be a way to deliver this in a more affordable way over time so that our land prices remain stable while our salaries and wages increase.
Now, I understand that you want to create an incentive, but could 50% be too high? Do you think you'll get pushback from the public and developers in particular?
Well, every council I've been to see and every land developer who deals with council has said that is the most practical policy we've heard. What it means is councils, when they're signing off consent applications, sometimes for just four or six homes in an existing residential area, sometimes for dozens or hundreds in a new development, it's council arguing about who's going to pay to upgrade all of the bulk infrastructure down the line that developers say holds up their projects the most. So councils and developers and, of course, future homeowners who want to get into these new builds, whether they're in a higher density building up in the city or in a new subdivision on the edge of town, they just want the opportunity to get into their new home as soon as possible. The more homes we can deliver to the market on more affordable land means that over time there will be a downward pressure on house prices. And that means that for younger people thinking about, well, after I finish study and after I've been working for a few years, is it more or less likely I'll be able to afford the home I want to start in? Well, under ACT, we say you will.
Now, this extra money into council would incentivize them to build more housing, but it doesn't change the shortage in construction workers and resources. Does ACT have any policies or plans to help manage this shortage?
You're absolutely right. And there are estimates that New Zealand is up to 100,000 workers short in construction. Now, for many, many decades, governments have started projects, whether it's a road project or building a new hospital, but without anything else to go on to, or simply cancelling the last government's project list, it's meant a whole lot of resourcing issues have just grown over time. And when a big project or a pipeline of work is cancelled or put on hold, New Zealand workers simply look across the Tasman and they go to Australia, where wages and salaries are already higher and they have a much more definite program and pipeline of work. That's why ACT believes our 30-year infrastructure plans, some places around the world, they call them city deals. There's different names for them, where the city and the region nominate the infrastructure they're going to deliver. That then becomes the pipeline of work that successive governments can't come and tip over. The problem we've got now is politicians go around the country, like effectively like political Oprah Winfrey's, saying, you get a bike bridge, you get a new road, you get a tunnel. By the way, when you look under your seat, there's no money. So what ACT says is we can't keep doing it like that. If we want a pipeline of work that's enduring, then employers will invest in people, they'll invest in plant and equipment, and that is how we will actually attract more people into a workforce. It's just a more consistent long-term pipeline of work. Some people know they sign up to work in construction or any of the support roles, transport planning, resource management planning, freight, supply, logistics, quarries, that they will have a long-term and enduring workflow ahead of them so they can plan where to live, where to send their kids to school.
You also want to scrap the Resource Management Act. Can you explain how this relates to and plans to improve the housing crisis?
Well, the Resource Management Act has been pointed to by successive governments and many experts as creating too many barriers to developing land for housing, and it's also imposed huge costs on the economy. The most recent research done by the Independent Infrastructure Commission, which is an independent agency of government, showed that $1.3 billion had been spent in the previous year just on consenting alone. And so that represents somewhere between 5 to 15% of project costs. In other comparable countries, consenting and permitting is between 1 and 2, sometimes as high as 5% for really complex projects. So that's why we need to reform the Resource Management Act. What Labor has done is actually going to make it much more complicated to get consents because it introduces new concepts to their Natural and Built Environments Act, which replaces the current RMA, new concepts such as Te Oranga o Te Taiao, which I understand translates to meaning the health of the environment. But in order to actually have a definition landed, it's going to have to go all the way to the Supreme Court. That could take a decade. It's going to be lots of arguing. Actually, there's a much simpler way to do it. We just go back to a common law approach and a focus on property rights. So you can use under ACT's proposal what we call our alternative solutions to building New Zealand and conserving nature. People who own property will be able to develop it, and the only ones they'll have to engage with are their neighbours. And if the neighbours object, and it's a matter of height, shading, noise, hours of operations, for example, then they can go to a planning tribunal and they can have either a valuation or an order made, which the developer will have to comply with. We think that's a much more streamlined way rather than forcing applicants to go through consent hearings where all kinds of people can, through notification, can be allowed to come and object. It slows everything down. It costs a whole lot of money. ACT believes if you've got property, you want to develop it, you should only have to consult with your neighbour. There'll be many, many housing developments that can go ahead much more quickly as long as the neighbours are either compensated or assured.
Now, obviously, you're not scrapping all guidelines. So are you going to be creating or formulating a new management act that will be more focused on developing?
ACT is proposing what our alternative, we call that ACT Solutions for Building New Zealand and Conserving Nature. And it has two legs to it. One is environmental protection. We do not believe that the current Resource Management Act or Labor's replacement is going to help improve the environment in a way that New Zealanders expect the law to. At the moment, if you have a resource consent, you can continue polluting for 25, 30, 35 years, whether it's a dairy farm, whether it's a factory or a sewage treatment plant run by council. ACT believes that polluters must pay, and where pollution is excessive and above baselines, particularly when it comes to fresh water, that once local councils set the environmental limit for what is acceptable pollution, then all permits need to be traded within that limit. And it may well be that many people carrying out polluting activities simply can't afford to continue polluting, and they'll sell their permits to someone else, and over time pollution will be managed down. When it comes to actually delivering land for housing, we need a separate Urban Development and Infrastructure Act. At the moment, environmental and infrastructure and development are integrated under the RMA. We need to separate them out so that the infrastructure and the urban development side of things can simply be viewed through, does it comply with a code of practice? Are the building materials acceptable? Does the engineer sign off the plans? Can you get insurance? At which point, go ahead with your development. You shouldn't need to ask for permission and go through extensive consenting when you, essentially, the developer is taking the risk on the build.
The Last Pledge Act has, in relation to the housing crisis, is to reform the Building Act. Could you walk us through some of the reforms that you plan to make?
The Building Act regulates building materials and how we assemble buildings. So at the moment, building materials have to be approved for use in New Zealand. Each council has its own approval process. I used to work at Auckland Council and I sat next to the guy who was in charge of the approval process. He had that many applications stacked up around his desk, you couldn't see the guy. It's just too slow to get building materials that are equivalent to what we already use in New Zealand approved. That's why ACT would establish a materials equivalence register, say for structural products or cladding products, windows, window frames. If they're acceptable for use in equivalent countries like Japan and California, Australia, Europe, for example, then we wouldn't require councils to give them approval. They would simply be added to the equivalence register, and any designer or builder who wanted to use them and followed the manufacturer's instructions could use them. The second thing we want to do is, rather than have councils take all the risk for signing off building consents, we'd like to offer the developers the opportunity to have their own building inspectors and insurers insure the product. Because when you're building a home, you already need to get contract works insurance if you're a developer. You don't want the building falling over halfway through the build. And there's no reason why at completion, if the engineer, the architect, or the designer, whoever it is, has signed off to say that you've completed the building according to the design and to the manufacturer's specifications, then private insurer is going to continue offering insurance on that property. That should be sufficient. At the moment, we're asking councils to sign everything off, which means they have to take all the risk on whether the building complies. ACT believes that should sit with the developer and their insurer. That would speed things up, definitely. But over time, particularly for larger scale developments, significantly reduce the cost of compliance, which means that homes are delivered to Kiwis at a more affordable price.
That was ACT MP Simon Court talking about some of the party's policies to tackle the housing crisis.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
University of Auckland Professor of Economics Susan St. John recently released an article discussing the state of low-income households in the upcoming election. I spoke to her about her article and research that looked at the In-Work Tax Credit, or IWTC, and the areas in which it was failing low-income households. We also discussed the policies that Aotearoa's two major parties, Labour and National, have pledged. This included their promise to increase low-income households to $50,000 by 2026, as well as Labour's forgotten promise to review and change the IWTC system. In your article, you start off by saying that Aotearoa's two major parties, Labour and National, have pledged to increase in-work tax credit, but there is no sign of Labour's previously promised review and change of working for families. Why is this review so important?
Well, because working for families is so complicated and it's got objectives that are contradictory. It's not doing a good job in addressing child poverty. And it is very, very hard on the working low-income families who find that they're earning just in the bracket where they start to lose their working for families at a very high rate.
Overall, looking at the big picture, what kinds of fundamental changes do we need to see?
We need to see an emphasis on the needs of children. We need to put children at the centre. And if you did that, the last thing you would do would be to increase the in-work tax credit, because the way that the in-work tax credit works is to penalise families, particularly in times that we're going through where we've had many natural disasters, we've got a recession, families are losing hours of work. They can only have 2 weeks if they have no paid work and still get the in-work tax credit for their children. And if they have to go on to any benefit, even a part benefit, then they're not entitled, their children are not entitled to that assistance, which is approaching $100 under the new policies that's been announced. So it's a considerable amount per week for a family to suddenly find is cut out of their budgets simply because they've fallen on hard times. But working for families is really badly designed.
Now, you also talk about poverty and paid work. What are some of the problems that the IWTC is creating with its policy to withhold payments when a household loses paid work?
Well, one of the issues with the in-work tax credit is that it adds to the other family tax credit, and that whole package starts to reduce over a very low income threshold of $42,700, and that's been fixed since 2018. And when families earn $1, if you think about it, just say the extra dollar earned over that threshold, they not only pay tax on that dollar, that they lose entitlement to 27 cents of their Working for Families. And it could be they also lose entitlement to some of their accommodation supplement, and many of them have student loans, so they're paying 12% on that as well. So it means that the extra dollar that's earned can leave very little in the hand, which is an incredible work disincentive. Can you see the irony here? That here we've got a system that's got massive work disincentives built into it, and yet they're trying to pretend that it's about incentivizing.
The current Labor and National proposal is to increase low-income households to $50,000 by 2026, which you say is too late and not enough. Instead, households need to be at $53,000 now just to match inflation. Now, taking all of this into account, is it possible to reach this number, and if so, how?
Well, it's because we do not have annual indexation of the threshold that we get into this situation where its value is so eroded that in order just to bring it back in line with inflation, you've got to push it up quite a lot. And I've suggested about 53 might be where it should be sitting. To put it up to 50,000 in 2026, so we're talking 3 years out, just before the next election, it's like pushing it so far down the road that essentially it's ignoring the problem. And we're going to have that fixed threshold in place for all these years up to 2026, and then it's only going to be lifted up by an amount that is not even going to match inflation.
Towards the end of your article, you express the need for a better system, and you suggest giving the full WFF package to low-income families regardless of employment status. Could you explain what this would mean and why it would solve some of the systemic issues we are currently facing?
Well, at the moment, the people who miss out are the worst off. The worst off children are not eligible for that part of Working for Families that's called the in-work tax credit, but it's just a payment for children designed to meet and prevent poverty. So we deny that to all the children whose parents do not fulfil the criteria, and in particular are accessing some kind of benefit or even a part benefit. They could be working 20 hours a week, but if they've got any part benefit at all, their children miss out. So we should get rid of the in-work tax credit by adding the amount of the tax credit to the family tax credit that goes to all children on the same basis. And if we did that, we would give a really much needed boost to the worst off families without pushing it all the way up the income scale, which is what happens, or what will happen, with this increase to the in-work tax credit.
That was Professor of Economics Susan St. John talking about what this election will mean for low-income households.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
And we'll be right back. Keep it on the B.
The Lovers, the debut album from Macy, is out now. After a stream of sparkling singles, Macy's first album has dropped, and it's a stunner. We're giving away copies on vinyl, so get your B-card number and stay tuned to BFM Drive all week for your chance to win. The Lovers, the debut album from Macy, out now. Available where good music is found.
Tony here from Tika Witty. Well, I've been listening to your sheep show every week with the girls week in, week out, and I hold out for some actual sheep content. You know, it's all music, and I've had a gutful. How about a little less the clean and a little more how to clean your Toyota Hilux after a massive dagging session? Either pull your bloody head in or change the name of the show.
Vinophiles are welcome to listen, but Freak the Sheep is really about that good, good New Zealand music. Taylor McGregor hand delivers interviews, live performances, tempered classics, and wretched demos from God's Own. Freak the Sheep with Taylor McGregor. Every Wednesday night from 9 till 11 on 95 BFM.
The evening's getting on, isn't it?
The Wire.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wives. Wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
University of Auckland Professor of Criminology Alice Mills recently conducted a study looking at the state of housing for those leaving prison. We talked about the lack of support that is available and how this can harm the rehabilitation of prisoners and their whānau. This included the strong correlation the study found between the lack of stable housing and prisoners ending up back in prison. We also discussed the impact on Māori and the even more severe lack of support for those communities and what support needs to be developed. To start off, could you tell us a little bit about the study you conducted looking at housing for those that leave prison and what the current system looks like for assisting ex-prisoners with housing?
Going Straight Home is a study that aims to look at the relationship between stable housing and reduced reoffending after release from prison. The current system in terms of housing is when somebody is released from prison, if they have served less than 2 years, then they will have access to something called out-of-gate services, or if they're on remand, they'll also, if they're released from prison, that is, they'll have access to out-of-gate services. These are, broadly speaking, navigational services, so they may help people get some housing, but they won't necessarily be able to give them housing per se. If they have served 2 years or more, they may be able to get access to various supported accommodation schemes that are run by community providers and funded usually by corrections, sometimes MSD, with assistance of Housing and Urban Development as well. Generally, though, when someone is released from prison, they are given the Steps to Freedom grant, which is up to $350, and it is usually, most people get $350. That, of course, is supposed to tide them over for about 2 weeks before they can get access to benefits, and generally that is not going to be enough, nowhere near sufficient to last 2 weeks. It might pay for 1 week's rent if you're lucky. And even then leaves very little either for food or clothing or various other things that people need to re-establish their lives. There will, of course, be some people who are able to go back and live with Whānau, and some people who may own their own homes that they were able to go back to. But at the moment, there is no help. If you own your own home and you go into prison, there's no help there basically enable you to keep your home. It may be possible to do that, but it's generally something that you yourself have to organise. There's no help from corrections or anybody like that.
And what are the direct harms that this lack of help causes the prisoners and their families?
Well, there are several, really. The first one is it may make it very harder for them to reconnect with whānau, particularly tamariki, particularly children. So we asked people what they found the hardest thing after leaving prison, and we asked them about difficulties in terms of finding housing. A lot of people weren't necessarily going to be released so that they were homeless on the street, but they're often going into things like hostel accommodation. And we heard many people saying that they really didn't want to go into that form of accommodation, not least which because there were lots of different rules and things like that, but also because it meant that it wasn't felt to be a safe place that children could visit. So that's the first thing that I want to highlight. Secondly, it can also make it very hard for somebody to get a job. We know that if they are in stable housing, they're much more likely to have that mindset to be able to get a job, to have that support around them as well that is going to enable them to keep going, keep attending a job. So it's also kind of really important in terms of employment. And also our research suggested that those with stable housing were more likely to be re-imprisoned than those without stable housing as well. So there is that a potential connection in terms of re-offending as well.
In your research paper, you say that those with stable housing prior to their imprisonment should get the support they need to keep that housing. What kinds of support are we looking at here to help them keep this housing?
Well, there are several different forms of support to try and help people keep their housing, that many of which take place in other jurisdictions. So really, in other jurisdictions such as England, Wales and Scotland, somebody will come into prison and they will be given a housing assessment. And what that means is somebody usually working on behalf of the prison, not normally necessarily the prison themselves, will ask them about their housing. And if they're in either on remand or just for a short period of time, they may try and actually take action to support that housing. Now, that all largely depends on financial support. I mean, some other jurisdictions, for example, people who are on remand for, say, a year or less can access benefits in order to ensure that their rent or mortgage or whatever can be paid. And similarly, if they're in for short sentences, then often there's a limit on how long they can apply for that kind of assistance from the state. But usually there is something there, say up to 13 weeks. So it's about trying to enable people to try and keep their housing when they come into prison.
The other thing is that if people are on long-term sentences, it might not be possible to save their housing when they come into prison, but it might be possible to save their belongings and minimise the amount of debt that they're going to be in. So in that case, you might have a housing officer in a prison, for example, actually negotiate with the landlord and with family and arrange for somebody to collect that person's belongings, which may also include identification documents and other paperwork that can be really hard to kind of re-establish life after prison without. So it's about saving their possessions rather than having them thrown out onto the street. It also may involve negotiating with landlords, which may be kind of the state or local council, as well as kind of private landlords, about trying to reduce the amount of debt that they get into as a result of unpaid rent as well.
Your study also found that Maori were more likely to live in unstable housing and even more likely to move several times after they leave prison. Now, what is the driver behind those kinds of statistics?
So we think that's predominantly about the fact that Maori are more likely to face discrimination in terms of housing. So more likely to face discrimination, particularly in the private rental market, for example. We also need to bear in mind that during the course of us doing this research, the number of people on the state housing or the social housing waiting list has gone up quite substantially, as well as that may also be part and parcel of it as well, is that people who are likely to more likely to need social housing may struggle to get that because of the high numbers of people in that position. And of course, we also need to bear in mind the impacts of colonisation, notions of intergenerational trauma, and also in some cases ongoing criminalisation as well. That's something that has happened kind of across generations. But all of that is going to have an impact in terms of people's access to housing.
That was Professor of Criminology Alice Mills talking about her research regarding ex-prisoners and housing support.
The endless parade of time. Who can say what fruits the future will see ripen? We can only keep looking towards
tomorrow's world.
Kia ora and welcome to Tomorrow's World. I'm Leilani, and this week I spoke to Dr. Joseph Gullen about how kakapo population sequencing is providing a breakthrough in understanding conservation genetics. Can you explain the significance of high-quality sequencing for the kakapo population and its impact on conservation efforts?
Yeah, so with the high-quality sequencing and then the high-quality genotyping, we're able to capture genetic diversity of pretty much the entire species. And as you know, genetics are passed from parents to offspring. So we've captured all the genetic variation. It's just going to be in different combinations in the offspring, which is really exciting. This is a world first, I believe, for its impacts in conservation. This allows us to give the Kakapo Rangers, the Department of Conservation Management team, as you know, Kakapo are an intensively managed species, we're able to equip them with more information than they've had available before. So this is looking at things such as inbreeding, how are the current levels of genetic diversity, and we found that they've done a pretty good job of that so far, of maintaining genetic diversity, minimizing inbreeding. But we're able to take that a bit further and begin to associate these genetic variants with differences in traits. So things like size. So we looked at the early growth rate of kakapo, so the first 60 days, and we're able to determine, based off the parents, that kind of growth curve for the first 60 days. You know, as the young grow, for pretty much all species, it starts off kind of slow, then rapidly speeds up, and then plateaus. And the point with that is kind of leaning towards a personalized medicine approach. So if we can identify small chicks that are growing either too slow or possibly too fast, the earlier we can detect that, the earlier we can trigger veterinary intervention, giving them the highest chance to succeed at life. We're able to also look at things like egg fertility, failed embryos, but also put in place things to look at disease with the genetics. So they suffered from a few diseases. One is crusty bum or cloacitis. Another was aspergillosis. We don't know what's coming in the future. Wish we did. But we'll have in place the ability to run these genetic analyses right away as the situation evolves. And thus, if some birds are naturally resistant to a disease, they can be placed with the sick ones because, you know, there's limited space, whereas others may be much more susceptible, and then special precautions could be taken to safeguard them.
How can the methods and code developed in this project be applied to other endangered species and conservation efforts?
So this is part of a large collaboration of international researchers, and we had a few goals. One of those is to go from the theoretical sciences to actually apply the sciences on the ground. Now that we're on the ground, it's the Kakapo management team, but we're able to feed in information to them, which is really exciting. And we have all this, so we have the methods we've developed. We have also the code we've developed, which has all been put up on GitHub. So it's publicly available, and others can use this to basically bootstrap or kickstart their conservation efforts, their conservation and genomics efforts. And it kind of helps speed them along the process of getting everything in place to do this. So we're hoping that not only will it be beneficial for Kakapo and hopefully other Aotearoan species, but hopefully worldwide it'll at least give them a head start on these sorts of analyses, as well as kind of a blueprint.
What can you tell us about the collaborative platform Genomics Aotearoa and its role in advancing genomics and bioinformatics research in New Zealand?
Genomics Aotearoa is a collaborative effort to work with both universities, maybe a private company or two, as well as a lot of the CRI, the Crown Research Institutes, like Plant and Food and Ag Research and others, to kind of create a social network allowing researchers to communicate directly. Bioinformaticists, usually a lab will have zero or one bioinformaticist, and thus there's not a lot of communications between them. GA facilitates that communication between all these bioinformaticists. It provides funding for different projects, and the goal is to enhance Aotearoa's ability to compete in the worldwide stage for genomics and bioinformatics. And I think we are absolutely competing now with high-quality research.
That was Joseph Goulin talking about his genome sequencing research to help the endangered Kakapo species.
Looks like everything's going to be all right.
Tomorrow's World.
And we'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
NZ On Air presents the Student Radio Network Awards 2023. This year, the main event will be hosted by Radioactive and Te Whanganui Ākara at Massey University's Tea Gardens. On November 4th, we will come together to celebrate the musicians, broadcasters and volunteers from across the motu who breathe life into the SRN and our local music community. Save the date. NZ On Air presents the Student Radio Network Awards 2023 on November 4th. Streaming and broadcasted live across the Student Radio Network and SRN.
The original
originator.
95. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. On the 11th and 12th of September, a group of activists protested Aerospace New Zealand's Aerospace Summit in Ototahi, Christchurch. The summit was promoted as an opportunity to discuss climate and sustainability issues in the industry. I spoke to Stop the Space Waste organiser Sam Murphy first, who was part of the protest, about their concerns with the summit and the aerospace industry in Aotearoa. Here is that interview.
The protest was organised by a number of groups, including a group that we set up specifically around the Aerospace Summit, and other groups include Peace Action Wellington, Auckland Peace Action, and School Strike for Climate Ototahi. So there are three main reasons that we decided that we would come together to protest the Aerospace Summit. One is that we are opposed to the militarisation of space. Some of the sponsors and attendees of the summit include Lockheed Martin, who are the world's largest weapons manufacturer, and they are a manufacturer of nuclear bombs, as well as Rocket Lab, a military contractor owned in the United States. So Ōtautahi, Christchurch, is a peace city. We have a sister city status with Nagasaki, which is one of the only cities in the world that has been hit and devastated by a nuclear bomb. So we think it's 100% inappropriate that we would be welcoming a nuclear bomb manufacturer into our city. The second major reason for our protest is that we are in a climate crisis. We've got 6 years to reduce emissions by 50% to avoid the worst impacts of global warming and hopefully stay below 1.5 degrees of global warming. The aerospace industry includes aviation and companies that are putting rockets up into the outer atmosphere and into orbit. Aviation is responsible for 3.5% of global warming. The aviation industry has no real plan to decarbonize. The companies involved at the summit include Christchurch International Airport and Air New Zealand. Christchurch International Airport purchased land down in Tauira with the view to building a new international airport to bring 4 million passengers per year into central Otago. This is completely out of line with where we need to be going with climate. Air New Zealand have no real plan to decarbonise. If you have a look at their website, you'll see a lot of cartoon, which are non-existent or future technology that aren't ready now and aren't going to be ready in time to do the transition to net zero that we need aviation to do. Aviation really needs to be thinking about how we reduce the number of flights, not trying to get themselves out of that problem with technological fixes. The third reason that we were protesting was out of solidarity with Rongomai Wahine Iwi, who are based off at Mahia Peninsula. Rocket Lab has built a launch site on their whenua. Rongomai Wahine say that Rocket Lab actually lied to them when consulting with them to get permission to put the launch site on their whenua. They made the promise that they would never do military launches from that site, and it's publicly on the record now that they have gone against that. They have been launching military hardware, therefore have broken the promise that they made with Mana Whenua, as well as a number of other environmental concerns from the rocket launches and issues with access to Wahi Tapu and places like Urupā and Mahinga Kai.
In your opinion, is there any way that the aerospace industry could improve?
That's a really good question. The aerospace industry is basically anybody who puts stuff in the sky. The aerospace industry could improve by, in New Zealand, could improve by cutting its links with military companies and military contractors. They could improve by and being more transparent about the types of activities that they're involved in and the implications of that. For example, for New Zealand's nuclear-free status, they could improve by stopping their greenwashing when it comes to the technologies that they claim are going to allow us to have carbon-neutral flights, because the reality is the technology that they're talking about is either unproven or will be impossible to run at the scale that aviation is working at the moment. And that's just due to the physical limitations of needing a really energy-dense liquid fuel to fly an aeroplane across the Atlantic. And then I think the last thing I would say is they could improve by, stopping what I consider to be unnecessary space launches and unnecessary journeys, such as like space tourism, is a quite ridiculous thing to be doing in a climate crisis. I think a 6-minute space flight is equivalent to flying a whole jumbo jet across the Atlantic.
I also spoke to Aerospace New Zealand President Mark Rocket about what they believe are misconceptions about the aerospace industry. I started off our interview asking Rocket about the purpose of the summit and who was involved.
The purpose of the New Zealand Aerospace Summit was to, well, it's an opportunity for an important emerging high-tech industry here in Aotearoa to come together, to discuss issues and opportunities that will contribute to its continued growth and sustainability. The aviation, aerospace and space, or, you know, aviation and space or aerospace industry is currently worth around $2 billion per year to the New Zealand economy and has the potential to grow really quickly with the right policy and regulatory settings.
Several activists groups protested your event, including Stop the Space Waste, who told us that they condemn the climate impacts of the aerospace industry and the ecological impacts of rocket launches from Aotearoa. Did you anticipate there would be backlash over your event?
Yeah, well, there are misconceptions about the industry. Some people think that it's just all about the military war machine, but there's so much more about the aerospace industry. It contributes to people's everyday lives. You know, aviation is a key in connecting people, and space-based high-altitude infrastructure plays an important role in our lives. You know, we use satellites to predict weather, track climate change, help with disaster relief. You know, there's so many different aspects of technology that we use. I mean, there's always going to be some people that have a different interpretation on things, and it's everyone has a right to protest, and you know, that's fine.
The summit was sponsored by Lockheed Martin, which is the world's largest weapons contractor and a producer of nuclear weapons as well. Stop the Space Waste told us that they're particularly opposed to the involvement of Lockheed Martin because of Christchurch's sister city status with Nagasaki, Japan, who has obviously been devastated by a nuclear bomb. Do you stand by Lockheed Martin's involvement in this event?
Lockheed Martin have supplied the New Zealand Defence Force and RNZAF for more than 50 years, and they work with the New Zealand Police. Now, they are a sizable global organisation with many employees, and they have a large space program. You know, we believe companies operating in the sector have a right to participate, and conversations need to include all players to be productive. If you look at the agenda items that we had as part of the summit, you know, there were all sorts of panels on things like ethics in space and Indigenous leadership, you know. So you'll think these conversations are really important to have. And I think New Zealand has a really unique opportunity to play a different role in the aerospace industry. You know, we can do things in a different way to many other countries.
The activists have also condemned the use of Aotearoa, in particular Māori land, for military purposes. For example, Rocket Lab's Mahia facility. Is this something that you have concerns about?
Well, Rocket Lab is an important participant in the New Zealand aerospace market and is meeting government policy and regulatory requirements. It was just one participant of many that were at the summit. We have many New Zealand-based companies involved in some aspect of space, aviation, advanced aviation. So, you know, all of these voices have the right to be heard.
You promoted the event as focusing on sustainability and as an opportunity to discuss climate and sustainability issues in the industry. Can you tell us about some of the discussions that were had and what plans the industry does have to improve its climate and environmental impacts?
Yeah, the theme of this year's summit was launching a sustainable future, and it was an important opportunity to consider how we can grow this high-value sector sustainably and with the next generation in mind. Many participants have a strong commitment to sustainability goals, including electric and renewable energy. And again, we have so many different aerospace technologies that touch on our lives. In New Zealand, we rely on space-based technology daily. I'll say it again. In New Zealand, we rely on space-based technology daily. So if you look at GPS, for example, we have satellite-based navigation systems to inform key technologies from power grids to banking systems and even to dating apps.
Do you think that things like space tourism are unnecessary during a climate crisis?
Yeah, there's all sorts of different ways to look at the emerging aerospace technology. I mean, if you look at the Apollo program, the technology that was developed as part of that was incredible, and it had massive flow-on effects throughout the world. And, you know, personally, I believe that aerospace technology, space flight, is really important, and there are many different aspects to that. But if we do have regular commercial services to space, I believe that a lot of that technology will flow into everyday lives. And yeah, there are many other kind of aspects, such as the overview effect, where people that do get exposed to seeing the Earth will, you know, a lot of them go back to having very environmental messaging in the work that they do in the future.
Activists have accused your event of greenwashing the aerospace industry. What do you make of this assessment?
Yeah, there are many different types of companies in New Zealand doing different work, but certainly there's a predominant theme of electric technology, sustainable technology. So if you look at a lot of the people that were talking at the event and exhibiting at the event, a lot of them care very deeply about sustainability, and I think it's a really large voice in the aerospace community that we have in New Zealand.
Do you think as a whole the aerospace industry could be more transparent about its activities to demystify things that are going on and what you've called misconceptions about the industry?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The last panel we had was called The Next Generation, where we had a lot of younger people sort of talking about what they think of the aerospace industry and how they would like to see it evolve. And one of the messages that came out of that is, as an industry, we need to really get better at communicating the technology and how it does benefit people and their lives. So I think certainly the aerospace industry, and probably a lot of tech industries, can do a better job at communicating the work that they're doing.
Because it is an election year, what policy around the aerospace industry in Aotearoa would you like to see?
The aerospace industry is coming up to the size of the wine industry, and yet most people don't even realise that it exists. I'd certainly love to see politicians getting in behind and supporting the industry. We could become a leading aerospace nation in the world. We're already doing amazing developments, and I'd love to see us turn into an aerospace technology nation that are doing a whole bunch of really interesting aerospace projects.
That was Stop the Space Waste organiser Sam Murphy, followed by Aerospace New Zealand President Mark Rocket, with their opinions on the aerospace industry in Aotearoa.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēne wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēne rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Simon Court, University of Auckland Professor of Economics, Susan St. John, Associate Professor of Criminology, Alice Mills, Postdoctoral Researcher with Genomics, Aotearoa University of Otago, Joseph Goulin, and Stop the Space Waste Organiser Sam Murphy and Aerospace New Zealand President Mark Rocket. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.